The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Doug Scioca, CEO of Kvar Capital Partners. Doug, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks, Kathleen.
Well, Vonnie and I are very excited to have you back on the show. Boy, where should we start? We had the economic news overnight from China. We've got a German number. Ukraine, as Vonnie just mentioned, continues to simmer. The tensions with Russia, but earnings do seem to be front and center now.
Which I think is good. I mean, our theme going into this year is the market is going to be absent multiple expansion, which means if you take that out of your expected return calculus for 2014, you're going to have to make assessments on a case-by-case basis that are going to focus on execution, tangible distribution of free cash flow, and not purely aspirational type of growth and momentum stories that predominated the headlines and really the performance tables in 2013. So I think you take, like you said, Ukraine, you take China credit weakness one day and China GDP improvement, particularly on the retail sales number, another day, you take a German confidence drop, you've got this disjointed data points on our domestic inflation picture. And I mean, it really adds up to quite a bit of choppiness, considerable volatility. And I think the market is getting a little bit used to that, which I think is healthy.
So, Doug, what are you saying? Are you saying look for companies that are using their cash?
Yeah, I think so, Vonnie, and good morning. I think with at the corporate level, right, decisions have to be made from the prototypical hoarding that's become reasonably common over the last few years is somewhat of a reflection of a lack of confidence in domestic and global growth, to the realization that we may actually see an elevation of interest rates, and nothing, right, is going to hasten a company's interest in borrowing money than the prospect of that cost of that money increasing in the near term. So that is sort of a fancy way of saying we think we're going to see an increasing velocity in the market. I think that could be very disruptive if you're not only focusing on dividends, but you're looking a little bit longer term for higher returns on capital. And I think that's going to get people's attention that felt like these companies had very slow, boring, progressive 1 and 2 cent beats. Now maybe they're looking a little bit longer down the line because they're hopeful that you get some economic traction and a higher cost of capital.
What form would it take, though, Doug? Would they be hiring or would they be just upgrading, you know, machinery and capital equipment?
I think both, right? And we've not seen enough tangibly in the labor data to indicate an elevation in workforce participation, but we've certainly seen some tendencies toward higher capital expenditures. And I think that's really positive, right? This has been, without question, the primary jobless recovery coming out of a recession than we've ever seen. And you can owe that a lot to efficiency, globalization, advancements of technology, and the like. But we're not only at an upgrade cycle technologically, but we're at an inflection point that relates to the transition in the underlying economy, one from being purely interest rate sensitive to be more economically, globally improving. Mm. And I think the companies are going to have to make advanced purchases to build CapEx to meet some sort of demand that they think is going to materialize in the future.
Doug, you know, you mentioned some themes broadly for stocks. What about the individual sectors? Where are you seeing some of those themes play out most?
Yeah, I think that within sort of the way we trailed off the last segment, within that capital expenditure area, we do really think that companies are going to have to retrench, examine their business models, deploy some cash. We've seen some of that cash deployment, and this is in some of the materials sectors, certainly the industrial sectors, in spanning outside the borders of the United States, right? We've seen a lot of elevation of profit growth off of very low expectations in some of the developed European countries as well. And we think that is going to have a tendency to carry forward if we do get sustainable underlying economic momentum, which we think we will, not without some disruption, but from a point-to-point basis, we think the improvement is going to be significant enough that companies are going to want to deploy their cash flow and their capital in very responsible fashion. So basic materials, industrials, U.S., and developed Europe, some of these companies that should be beneficiaries of capital expenditures. But we also think a theme that is going to make some sense, and this sort of straddles the line between the early cycle interest rate sensitive sectors and the later to mid-cycle economically sensitive sectors, are in some financial services stocks. We've seen some consolidation that has begun to be a little bit more regular and pronounced in regional and community banking, in insurance, and asset management. We think that scale is going to be a huge part part of the growth strategies of these companies, because in sort of a Volcker rule, Dodd-Frank universe, there's very little margin left.
And, true.
And you could even see some of that had come out from City Wells and
well, let's take a look then at some of these big banks, and let's start with Bank of America. Getting back to their loss, they had to pony up $6 billion. You know, tied to mortgage disputes.
Right.
And of course, it's very important that they finally reached agreements with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac so they can move forward, presumably put this behind them. Is it behind them now?
I hope so, Kathleen. It's really, they do. I think that when you swallow a company the size of Countrywide in the fashion that it was swallowed, when you take on the balance sheet exposure that Merrill Lynch had, and that was from more of a securitization standpoint, less conventional plain vanilla lending mistakes, or mistakes is fair to say, but less it relates to conventional lending miscues that had transpired in sort of the heat of the credit crisis. I think those skeletons kick around in the closet for quite some time until they're completely exercised, and hopefully that will do it. If you looked at the mortgage number from B of A, they actually had an increase in their mortgage servicing rights and a reduction in volume, particularly from new home sales, and we certainly have seen a dry up in the refi market, but the mortgage weakness has to be offset, we think, by an increase in loan demand, and that primarily is going to be C&I loans, small business lending. We're seeing a little bit of that, and Wells in particular highlighted that in their conference call, but I think that's going to be a really critical inflection point for these banks moving forward.
So at what point do you think that they might be good investments again, Doug?
Oh, I think they could be real good investments right now. But again, I think those that are going to be good investments are going to be those that have a better and a more direct focus on the transactional side of the business. So, you know, we talked years ago many years ago about kind of the vindication of Phil Purcell when he came in from Dean Witter to Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Stanley wanted to risk up the balance sheet, and Phil Purcell says, boy, you've got it all wrong. We need to focus on transactions. We need to reinvest in the broker desktop. We have to be involved in asset management because that is a scale-based business and not a margin-based business. And when you look at things like J.P. Morgan and Citi and what they've done, they're all trying to battle for that scale. They're trying to battle for those transactions. And we've seen some improvement, not so much in B of A, more in Wells and Citi on the fixed income commodity and currency business. I think that's going to be more heart and soul transactional volume-based businesses that are going to make these even better investments.
Well, you know, let's talk about Citi. Also reporting their earnings recently, we spoke to Dick Beauvais, as a matter of fact, on Monday, from Rafferty Capital Markets, who had a sell on Citi for, I think he said, for 4 months. He raised it to hold, impressed with some of the results in that report. But a lot of people still not believing in Citi.
Well, I think Citi flipped Mike Mayo too, Kathleen. I think he turned more constructive on the company, which I think is a very seminal moment from the standpoint of earning street credibility. So I think that they were stunned, Michael Corbett and his team, with the decline they had on sort of the return on capital plan that they'd put in when they'd failed the stress test. And hopefully that they're going to do what they need to do to get back in the good graces of the regulators, and then they can get to where they're going to earn the confidence back on the street. But they seem to do that a little bit with the earnings report that came out the day before yesterday, and they seem to have a lot more of a fan base that are looking at this opportunity as a value-oriented, attractive entry point.
What about Goldman Sachs? We still have to hear from them.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see because, I mean, they don't have that broad a revenue base. They certainly still stand to be slapped on the wrist more from a Volcker rule. When I say slapped on the wrist, I don't mean from a fine perspective, but from a business model realignment perspective than some of the other banks. And I think it's going to be very interesting because the investment banking outcomes of the banks that have reported thus far have been asymmetric, right? We've not seen any consistency where we would say, oh, well, sure, we've seen a pickup in M&A, and oh, sure, we've seen a lot more equity underwriting. We have, but it seems to be broadly dispersed. You look at a company like Moelis that went public today, right? Some of the reasons they have that confidence to go out to raise public capital is because they, as a boutique, have taken market share from a lot of the bulge bracket banks. So I think it's going to be really telling to see how Goldman reports.
But your bottom line on banking, on investing in financials, is go more for some of the big regionals as opposed to putting your money into some of these behemoths?
I think so, Kathleen. I think they've got the cash flow. They don't have sort of the regulation overhang. I think that they have a lot more flexibility. I think that they have passed the capital sufficiency test, and they've seen massive credit improvement. So you've seen a big drop down in some of the reserve capital because their loan losses have declined. They should be a lot more agile moving through this economy.
So, Doug, we've been speaking about various areas of the market. I want to ask you about the technology sector, because we did see a big sell-off, and yet earnings this week are not wholly disappointing.
Well, we saw a big sell-off last week. We saw that what tried to be a big sell-off yesterday afternoon, and then a pretty quick recovery. And I thought Barron's did a decent job over the weekend that we're trying to differentiate between tech and then the speculative excess that exists in some tech, not the entire sector. And I think there are certainly some companies that have reached valuations that are incorporating in you know, different terminology and analysis. And we're kind of expanding and stretching our brains to understand and defend some of the capital allocation. And I think whenever that takes place, when the proverbial paradigm has to be restructured, it could be problematic. I think that paradigms are in place for reasonable reasons and sort of anchored in reliable guideposts. And I think when tech gets a little bit far afield, sometimes it goes through a corrective process that's probably pretty healthy.
So where do we go from here? What are the next big earnings on your screen? Because, you know, it's going to be another couple of weeks of all kinds of industries, all kinds of companies. You know?
Yeah, it's great. It's the most exciting time to be in the business, without question. And I thought yesterday was so fantastic because you had J&J, you had Coke, you had Schwab, you had IBM. You know, fantastic four big blue chip companies with very little overlap in their business models and have been pretty consistent purveyors of free cash flow, and none of them really disappointed, and none of them really blew everyone out of the water either. And I think that, look, when you take the Fed's tailwinds out of the equation from a macro analysis, and you have to more microscopically look at the data points being provided by the companies, it's going to elevate the amount of volatility and price fluctuation on any given day on any given name, right? It used to be, and it still, I guess, is the sort of the flag-waving mantra of don't fight the Fed. Well, you know, when you're not fighting the Fed, and the Fed is slowly, albeit definitively exiting stage left, don't fight the Fed to us means, you know, basically bye-bye to the beta trade. And we love that because it does require a little more refined level of analysis on specific opportunities. And the next couple of weeks will sort of give us an idea as to where these companies are tracking versus expectations. And it's wonderful. And if you think, well, geez, the market might do $110 in the S&P and we apply a 16-17 multiple to that, we're reasonably fairly valued on that basis. And if we don't have multiple expansion, we could hover around this midpoint and security selectivity would be that much
okay,
more.
Okay, so just to kind of flesh out what you said, when you say the Fed exiting stimulus, basically bye-bye to the beta trade, in other words, it's your view that the many months and years of bond purchasing, et cetera, and holding the foot to the gas pedal created more volatility, created speculation, had the stock market a little bit frothy. Is that what you're trying to say?
I think it underwrote speculation, Kathleen. I think it massively suppressed volatility. And I think that is what lured people into taking risks that would otherwise be consistent with, number one, their intestinal fortitude, number two, responsible set of objectives. So I think with the Fed migrating away from being sort of that sponsor of risk-taking, we're going to actually finally see an elevation of volatility. And you can measure volatility a lot. I mean, intraday price fluctuation, point-to-point standard deviation in stocks, or the VIX. And we're at a near all-time high. The interest rates are moving up, albeit off the highs where we started the year from a rate standpoint, but year-to-year up over 100 basis points on the 10-year. And we still have low volatility as measured by the VIX. So I think that's due to elevate. I do think we're going to see upward pressure on rates from this point forward through the year. And I think it just underscores the need for selectivity on specific stocks, because I do think the Fed that was suppressing volatility and underwriting risk is beginning to move the other way, and they need to.
So do you go for safety then, Doug? And you know, does that mean something like the mega cap stocks?
I think the more boring, the better right now, Vani. And I think that quality trade was a bit absent when you look at what happened in 2013 and sort of the unwind that's taking place, and whether it's like Kathleen teed the segment off with understanding some of the fluctuation in schizophrenia and valuations on some of the NASDAQ stocks, whether it's the fact that, you know, the Dow was the biggest underperformer last year and the NASDAQ was consistently outperforming. I think that you do want to stay with some of the larger to mid-cap company stocks that have fantastic evidentiary ability to create and distribute free cash flow as opposed to aspirational business models. I think aspiring at this point and betting on the come of great growth opportunities and purely basing that analysis on momentum, I think could be fraught with a lot of risk going into 2014.
You did mention the sense of industrials rising, pump companies putting capital to work. What does this mean for Europe? What does it mean for emerging markets? Quickly, I'm sorry we didn't leave more time for this question. Mr. Curtis, what your thought is.
Oh, sure. I think emerging markets, I think Europe benefits more than emerging markets do. I think from an emerging market outside investment standpoint, there's still a lot of risk because I think the cheap labor pool that was available is starting to dry up. The natural resource base has begun to become more fairly priced. So seeing capital flow there as a viable alternative, when we see what's happening in the U.S., I think dollars are better off going to be in developed Europe and the U.S. at this point.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.